Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkins, sitting in for Don Matzett this week. You know, we can read in the book of Acts from the perspective of the evangelist Luke about what was going on in the lives of the early Christians in Palestine and as Paul traveled the Gentile world, the Roman Empire. That perspective is familiar to many of us as Christians. But the perspective from Roman history is often, well, we often ignore it entirely as though it had no bearing upon how the New Testament and the early church unfolded. We're going to talk in this hour with Dr. Paul Meyer, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan, about the events surrounding the first century Christian persecution in Rome. Our phone number is 1-800-730-2727. That's 1-800-730-2727. By the way, before we begin, Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and the 61st General Convention of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is taking place here in St. Louis this week. Today, the delegates to the convention elected Dr. Gerald Kieschnick, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and Pastor Dan Preuss, first vice president. So congratulations both to Dr. Gerald Kieschnick and Pastor Dan Preuss on their election to these offices in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Again, those phone numbers, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Paul Meyer is also author of numerous books, including a documentary novel titled The Flames of Rome. It'll serve as the outline for our conversation in this hour. Dr. Meyer, welcome to Issues Etc.
Todd, it's great to be back.
Tell us about the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire, later the Empire, up to the time of the Christian era. Give us the kind of the thumbnail sketch of Roman history up to the time, say, the book of Acts begins.
Well, it was a phenomenal situation in which we have an empire leading from a republic, leading from a monarchy era going backwards here, about 1,200 years in its total chronology. There's six times as long as America has been a nation, for example. An empire that will eventually spread from Britain to Babylon, and from the deserts of North Africa to the North Sea. It's an incredible phenomenon. It began as a republic in 753 BC. For about 200 years, they had kings. They didn't like them, and so they expelled the last one from Rome. And then in 509, the Roman Republic was born and lasted until approximately 30 BC. The great Augustus settled all the civil wars that took place, and the Roman Empire then begins from about 30 BC up to its fall in the West, in any case, in 476 AD. So those are the three great segments of Roman history. But the part that applies mostly to the New Testament will be the earliest empire period in Roman history.
Make that distinction, just for the sake of history's context, between Rome as a republic and Rome as an empire. What's the difference there?
Rome as a republic was quite democratic in the sense that the people elected the chief executive, or I should say chief executives, because there were two of them. They were called colleagues, and the Latin name for that is consul, consules. So they had two people at the top who could veto each other's acts and thereby prevent one person from getting too strong. And instead of a king reigning for his entire lifetime, these consuls were in for only 1 year. What a phenomenal limitation that was.
Term limits. Yeah,
indeed. And so this way they preserved the will of the people. And the patrician element, that's the top class in Rome, was still, with its money and political clout, able to pretty well control what was happening. But the people did have their representatives, their own tribunes to defend them. They had some plebeian consuls, for example. That's a lower class. And so there was somewhat of a more egalitarian society. Now, what happened, Todd, in the first century B.C., it went to pot, simply because the era of the strong man had arrived. First, there was Cornelius Sulla, who was opposed by Gaius Marius, and each had 50% control of the Roman legions. You know, because though the Republicans and the Democrats today had half control of the U.S. Army, Navy, and Air Force.
You know, a mess.
Your political differences in Washington would result in bloody battles.
So these are the civil wars you mentioned?
These are the civil wars of the first century B.C. And after that, there was Caesar versus Gnaeus Pompey. And after that, there was Octavian versus Antony. and Octavian was finally winner-take-all, and they thought number eight is kind of a strange name for this hero, so they called him Reverend instead. And the Latin name for Reverend is Augustus.
The first Caesar.
First real emperor was Augustus.
Okay. Now, since this period of the empire deals, overlaps, if you will, with what we call the New Testament era, how does it play in? We're talking about events that are simultaneous to the New Testament era, but are not mentioned much in the New Testament. We get Tiberius mentioned. We get a couple other
emperors. Well, except for St. Luke. Luke very carefully tells us in the Nativity account, of course, that this all took... In fact, the first person mentioned in the Nativity is neither Joseph or Mary or baby Jesus or shepherds or magi. It's a Roman Caesar, in this case, a Roman emperor named Augustus, the very person we're talking about. Luke wants to get the antennas of his hearers very much up and ready to get the message. Everybody knew about the great Augustus. He was, unfortunately, the very first emperor was the greatest of the emperors, and they kind of went downhill after that. Not always in every case, but he certainly had a spectacular reign. He was in power for about 44 years, and he had... there's no question the Romans loved him because he is the one who stanched all the bloodshed in the Roman civil wars. The winner take all finally was Mr. Indispensable as far as the Romans were concerned. Once he tried to leave Rome, and the Roman people teary-eyed, begged him to stay. So he hung in there for quite a while, and that's the beginning of the empire period.
When we meet the New Testament as a historical document, what is the extent of the Roman Empire? What are the state of affairs in the Roman Empire? At the beginning of the New Testament, in Luke's account, you mentioned before, what is the state of the empire?
Well, I think St. Paul had this in mind when in Galatians 4 he talks about in the fullness of time, when the time had fully come. God could not have injected himself into humanity in the form of Jesus Christ at a better time in the ancient world than that first century A.D. Because... from a human viewpoint, if Jesus would have come a century earlier, we might never have heard of him, so to speak, because of the horrible bloodshed that was taking place in the dueling for control in the empire. Now the Romans had the Pax Augusta, or the Peace Pax Romana, another name for it. They had spread the welcome blanket of peace across the whole Mediterranean world. Now they had hung up the traffic lights, so to speak. Now Paul can easily go on those three mission journeys by land and not have to worry about highwaymen or at sea and not worry about pirates. Now there was a common linguistic cement that held the Mediterranean world together in common commercial Greek, Koine Greek, the very Greek in which the New Testament was written. Now there was a government that really brought law and order. Basically, the Romans, I think, in our novels and in our movies, get a bum rap. They are always pictured as the horrible conquerors who were juicing the people out of their taxes. Listen, I would much rather pay Roman provincial tax as a Jew in New Testament times than American income tax. Much rather.
A lesser rate.
A lesser rate for sure.
All right. So the empire is at its zenith, if you will, when we meet it in the New Testament?
It's on the way to the zenith. If you wanted a zenith, I'd say the 2nd century A.D., time of the five good emperors, Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius in the 100s A.D. That's when the Roman engine was hitting on all cylinders, finely tuned and perfect. But it's on the way here. The trouble is Augustus was followed by Tiberius. He wasn't too popular. And then, of course, there was Gaius Caligula. Crazy boots, you know, mm-hmm. Caligula. And then we have Claudius, who's kind of doddering, but then Nero comes along. So we have some bad eggs in that first century. And again, the Roman people didn't know when they shifted to the empire that these guys were coming along. But that's the New Testament horizon, Todd, that first century. We begin with Augustus when Jesus is born, and we end with Paul appealing to Nero Caesar in the book of Acts.
Can you understand, and I'm not talking about a scholar's understanding, but can a Christian fully understand the scope and the context of the New Testament with no knowledge of what's going on in the Roman Empire at the time, with no bigger grid to lay over the top of the New Testament?
No, I don't think you can get a complete understanding without involving the political dimension. These things, as Luke says, didn't take place in a corner. This was not some religious vacuum. If Christianity were any other religious system in this world, or any of the made in America religious systems, then this thing would be, the sacred book would be in some vacuum corner that has no tangency with reality. But the beauty of the Christian faith is that it is so immensely historically verifiable. It has all kinds of points of tangency with the ancient world. And so you have throughout the New Testament references to the Roman government involved. They show Jesus a coin whose image and superscription is on there. Well, it's Tiberius Caesar in that case. We have Caligula in his run-in with Jesus' Jewish colleagues. We have Nero at several points again. We have to know who these people were. It was under Tiberius that the crucifixion took place. Well, what were his orders to the Roman governor Pontius Pilate? What were the Roman rules of evidence when it came to Good Friday? These are very important questions that are so often overlooked.
My guest in this hour is Dr. Paul Meyer, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. We're talking about the events surrounding the first century Christian persecution in Rome. If you'd like to join us, 1-800-730-2727. That's 1-800-730-2727. Folks, we're talking about events simultaneous with the New Testament and important to understand. I would dare say the better we understand the Roman history around this time, the better we will understand our own New Testament itself. When we come back, we're going to start with Emperor Claudius and find out about him.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
Don Matzitz back next week on Issues Etc. He's going to discuss tithing with Dr. James Bollhagen of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Does God demand a strict 10% of your money? If so, is it a 10% of the gross or of the net? And do we receive earthly blessings from God based on how much we donate to church? Don's going to talk about it next week on Issues Etc. His guest, Dr. James Bollhagen. If you want to know what we'll be discussing on Issues Etc. for the rest of the summer, check out the website we have, www.issuesetc.org. You'll find a list of the topics and the guests for the weeks ahead. My guest is Dr. Paul Meyer. We're talking about the events leading up to the first persecution of Christians in Rome. You can join us. 1-800-730-2727 is our phone number. Let's start with Emperor Claudius. You begin with Claudius's reign, or you begin in Claudius's reign, in your documentary novel called The Flames of Rome. Why do you begin there?
Well, what I wanted to do with The Flames of Rome was to pick up the story where my earlier historical novel, Pontius Pilate, left off. And Pilate came back to Rome just at the time that Tiberius died. And in the next administration, for 3.5 years, we have this madman, Caligula, in charge. And some early church fathers thought that probably Pilate committed suicide because he couldn't stand an appearance before Caligula. But I was able to demonstrate pretty well from other evidence, for instance, the church father Origen, that Pilate did not commit suicide. And when I was translating Eusebius in that other book of mine, I was concerned. Matter of fact, the reason that I wrote Eusebius was because of the mistranslation of a critical passage by Williamson. In which he said, it is on record that Pilate committed suicide. And I looked at the Greek, and the Greek was logos echai. Word has it that Pilate... I think that's a different thing, isn't it? It is on record that? A little bit firmer than word has it. So I figured, what else is wrong? That's related to the Eusebius translation. But anyway, Pilate did survive Caligula, and then, of course, we have no further solid historical information on Pilate. I think he spent his last days as a civil servant, maybe pondering that question he once asked, what is truth? I don't know. But we want to pick up the story now of how Christianity first reached Rome, and why did Nero persecute the Christians, and what happened to St. Paul's trial when he got to Rome? Well, who's in charge here? First, the Emperor Claudius was in charge during this period, from 41 to to 54 A.D., and then Nero is in charge from 54 to 68. And there is the rest of the panorama of the New Testament background when it comes to politics.
That gets us to the end of the New Testament. Okay. The typical view of the, and I think the popular view that most Christians hold of Roman persecution is something like this. Well, along came this crazy emperor named Nero, who was just really a terrible man in every respect, practically the devil incarnate. And he just had it out for Christians for no good reason. And so he persecuted them in vast numbers and nearly killed them all off. And they all ended up living in holes in the ground, the catacombs, fleeing from the empire. And this was just a bloody, unending persecution for Christians virtually from the time the New Testament ends.
Yes, and almost all of that is wrong in terms of the popular view. And you didn't ask Nero, you didn't have add Nero fiddled while Rome burned,
right,
and so
yes.
forth. Yeah, that's the final one.
That's the one, him standing on top of the Palatine fiddling.
Yes. The trouble is the fiddle will not be invented for 14 centuries yet, and so that alone is not going to work. There are elements of truth there, but mostly the situation is this. It was a horrible fluke that Christians ever got persecuted. Let me explain why. What happened was, no rain had fallen for weeks on end in the summer of 64 AD. Italy was a tinderbox. And periodically there were city fires that had broken out, and they caused moderate damage. But this time the Scirocco took over, the south wind, born in the deserts of Libya, shoots up the Italian peninsula and takes a local fire and blooms it out of all proportion because of the dryness of Italy that spring. And so it raged on for 9 days or 10. And much of Rome, about 30 to 40% of the heart of Rome was scorched.
How big is the city we're talking
City's
about?
City's about a million people at this time.
Closely packed, walled city.
That's right. Some living beyond the walls, of course, but they could always hurry inside the walls if enemies came. Now, here's the problem. In those days, we don't have ABC, CBS, NBC cameras to show where this accidental fire began. It began southeast of the Circus Maximus, which was the great hippodrome below the Palatine Hill, to the southeast. What happened was that a local fire bloomed out of control. Nero was 35 miles away at the time, so he didn't set fire to Rome. When he came back, in fact, he looks pretty good in terms of his first aid operations, throwing his palace open to house the homeless, opening up grain stores for the people, and so on.
And we got to remember, 35 miles is on a horseback half a day's journey.
Sure,
right?
It is. Sure.
Okay.
So he, if he were a firebug, if he were an arsonist, he'd want to be on hand, I think, when his great creation was daubing the night sky with horrible flames. But what happened is this happened on his watch, so to speak. You blame the top man in a catastrophe in the ancient world and in time since. Take the American election of 1932 when Roosevelt ran against Herbert Hoover. The Great Depression was on. I think they could have run Benedict Arnold against Hoover and he would have won. And so anybody would win. It happened on his watch, so to speak. Today, the public, frankly, is better informed because we have all kinds of media covering everything as it happens, not in those days. And so Rome becomes a blooming rumor factory. And now his government is in danger of collapse. And they had a summit-level meeting. And I think they probably went through various... Who can we blame this on? Was the topic of the discussion. An accidental fire, that's not going to satisfy the masses. They've lost parents, children, property, houses. They got to blame it on somebody. So they're going to give them a scapegoat. Who's it going to be? Maybe they thought the criminals of Rome. But no, the criminals would say they've been put up to it. And I really think somebody then suggested the Jews of Rome, because the Romans are kind of anti-Semitic. But Nero's wife, Poppaea, was very interested in Judaism, and she... again, halted that idea at its inception. But once they're on that category, guess who they're going to think about next? That special subsect of Jews called the Christiani, the Christians. And Nero probably thought there were a cult gang of maybe only, 50 people in Rome. Well, what happens is, just like a lie snowballs, they found that there were more and more and more. But they couldn't go back on themselves. The government had to cover it with a bigger lie. And that is how the Christians got blamed for the fire of Rome.
So we're talking about a natural disaster struck the city of Rome. And officially, the decision was made to blame someone. The Christians, the lot fell to the Christians. They thought maybe they were dealing with the small sect. It turns out that they had to persecute and punish a lot more people than they had bargained for. And how extensive is the persecution in the city of Rome by the time it's all over with?
Todd, before I answer that, just remember we have a fascinating passage in Cornelius Tacitus, who's our ace pagan Roman historian, who talks all about the fire of Rome. And he says that Nero arrested a vast multitude of people. Now, the Latin is multitudo ingens. Now, here's the point. There are so many texts that say Christianity was a movement that barely began seeping into the Mediterranean world. Luke's account is it was explosive. Pentecost, 3,000 converts, 5,000. Luke's right. In the very evidence of a pagan historian, we have an explosive beginning for Christianity because 1,500 miles away in one generation, we have so many Christians available, a vast multitude admitted by a pagan historian.
When we come back,
and that's only the ones they arrested, not those who went underground.
When we come back from this break, my guest, by the way, is Dr. Paul Meyer. This is compelling stuff, folks. When we come back from this break, we're going to find out the events leading up to this fire in Rome. That was the literally the match that lit the persecution upon the Christians. But why did Nero feel the need to blame somebody? What was happening to his reputation leading up to these days of persecution for the Christians? We'll get a little historic context from my guest, Dr. Paul Meyer, when we come back.
Noted author and history professor Dr. Paul Meyer on why he's a pastor in the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.
Well, first of all, I'd like to explain why I'm a Christian pastor. And that's simply because our faith has the strongest historical and archaeological credentials of any of the world religious systems by far. It's based on fact and not on myth. Specifically, I'm also delighted to be a pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod because we believe that Luther's teachings best reflect both Holy Scriptures and their interpretation in the early Christian Church. Our church holds true to those teachings without wavering, while at the same time sponsoring great educational programs as well as a worldwide mission outreach.
If you want to learn more about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, call our Issues Etc. resource line at 1-800-737-0172 and ask to receive a free pamphlet called What About the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? 1-800-737-0172.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
We're talking about the events leading up to the first persecution of Christians in the city of Rome during the reign of Emperor Nero. My guest, Dr. Paul Meyer, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and author of numerous books, including his documentary novel titled The Flames of Rome. By the way, you can purchase a copy of Dr. Paul Meyer's book, The Flames of Rome, and I do recommend it for your reading. It is not dry history, folks. There's nothing dry about this history. We were talking during the break, truth is far stranger than fiction, and he has put together a genuine documentary novel with about 25, 30 pages at the end of references to bona fide ancient historians to back up all the facts in the novel. You can purchase it directly through our radio program. The book's called The Flames of Rome. We'll send it to you for a contribution of $14 to Issues Etc. The price does include shipping and handling. So have your MasterCard, your Visa, or your Discover card ready and call the Issues Etc. resource line at 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. The book you want to ask for is called The Flames of Rome by Dr. Paul Meyer. The number again, 1-800-737-0172. You alluded to something earlier, Dr. Meyer, that Nero, when the fire happens in the city of Rome, that takes out, what, say, a third of the city? Is that too generous an estimate?
About 40%.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it really does some major damage. It even takes out Palatine Hill. Nero's own wealth is cost in this. When this happens, he has to find a scapegoat because it happened on his watch. But I take it from your documentary novel, up to this point, Nero's reputation with the Roman people had been sinking. Their fear of him had been growing gradually over this time. He did not want to be pinned with this, though. What's happened in Nero's career up to this point?
Well, Nero became emperor at much too early an age. He was only in his middle teens when he became emperor, over the poisoned flesh of his stepfather, I might ask,
This is Claudius.
His dear mother Agrippina had poisoned her husband, the fourth wife of Claudius, in order to make her son emperor. And without proper training, without proper previous political experience, here he's foisted right into command of the world, so to speak. That's the same problem that faced Gaius Caligula. And he wasn't able to handle it too well, but he did for a while. The first 5 years of Nero's administration were the finest government Rome ever had, according to the later Roman Emperor Trajan. Why were they so good? Because Nero wasn't running the show. His tutor, his professor, Aeneas Seneca, was running Rome in behalf of his ward.
And this
Seneca. He did such a beautiful job that it was a wonderful government for Rome. This is why St. Paul will appeal to Nero Caesar. You know, we always have at the end of Paul's ministry, he appeals to Caesar. Well, yeah, it's Nero. You see, Caesar's a generic term for Roman emperors, you know. But why would Paul, who had such political savvy, appeal to Nero? Well, Nero hadn't been bad yet. This was the opening first five excellent years when Nero's growing up, and Seneca is running the government for him. And another reason why Paul appeals to Nero is because Seneca's brother had let him off the hook in Corinth, Gallio.
Mentioned
the governor in Acts chapter 16.
Okay.
Acts chapter 18. Gallio, Lucius Junius Gallio, well known in Roman history, was the full-blooded brother of Aeneas Seneca. Do you see the beauty of Paul's apply here?
So let me see. We're going to, if you will permit me for just a second, to psychologize Paul when he's been arrested and he knows he's going to face a trial. He thinks, I've been in Corinth on trial before. Gallo let me off the hook. Gallo's brother has Nero's ear, Seneca. I'm going to appeal to Nero.
Smart. And Rome also pays for his transportation then to Rome. It's just perfect.
Okay.
It was a beautiful decision in Paul's part.
Tell us about Nero going bad. How did it happen? And what were some of the events that marked his downturn as an emperor?
Seneca's power over Nero resulted because the prefect of the Praetorian Guard, a fellow named Afranius Burrus, was also in Seneca's camp. He represented the power. Seneca represented the wisdom. But Burrus got throat cancer and died. That left Seneca alone. He was worried about Nero's bad tendencies anyway, so he retired from the government, went down to South Italy for the rest of his life. Now, a new person creeps into Nero's life, a fellow named Afonius Tigellinus. He was a fishmonger. He had, in fact, slept with Nero's mother illegally and so on. That's the kind of person he was. And he pandered to all of Nero's vices, and he is the one who led Nero down the garden path.
And when you say vices, you mean some pretty serious vices.
Oh, I mean vices of every kind, sexually.
Can you give us the PG-13 run-through on, and maybe not, maybe PG-13 is too much, but can you give us the run-through of what this new advisor to Nero encouraged his emperor to do?
Well, put it this way, he once gave a garden party in Nero's behalf for all the people who had invited Nero out that summer. By the way, Nero had planned to go to Egypt, and he would have gone to Egypt, but when he went into the Temple of Vesta to say goodbye to Rome, he tripped on the way into the temple. And that trip had terrible consequences, because now he called off the trip to Egypt. Now he's bored in Rome, and so all the nobility invite him out to dinners. Well, Tigellinus had to provide Nero's counter dinner then for all these wonderful invitations. Well, at the other dinners, they had various favors. You know, they had favors at banquets 2,000 years ago. Sometimes blankets of roses or perfumes of all kinds or jeweled turbans were some of the trinkets mentioned by Suetonius and also the Roman historian Tacitus. Now, what is Tigellinus going to provide in turn? He provided an orgy for the guests.
And it's a real orgy.
A real orgy involving girls, women, men, boys, whatever lurid taste you might have.
You tell the story, and I think this is this spot can even be somewhat accurately located in Rome. A pond.
Agrippa's pond.
Agrippa's pond. A barge goes around and around the pond,
exactly,
picking people up and letting them off on the bank. And on the banks of, up in the groves, on the banks of this pond, are virgins, boys and girls, men and women. And the guests are invited to go up and have their trysts and return, eat, drink, be merry, go back up, have some more trysts. And Nero's a part of this?
Well, certainly was the center of it. He was the great party giver, if you please.
Now, you also, this is just a little note, but you tell of a marriage that took place as a result of this very party. A homosexual union, if you will, between Nero and one of the young, what did they call them, cherubs at the time?
Well, catamites is the word I use because it doesn't sound dirty, but if you look up in the dictionary, you can see that it is a lurid sexual partner and so forth. What happened was that Nero, of course, was smitten by either sex, put it that way. And so he had catamites who were catering also to his fancy. Later on, he accidentally killed his wife, with whom he was deeply in love, Poppaea, the empress who protected the Jews. She was pregnant, and Nero came back rather late from the races one night, and she kind of gave him a tongue-lashing, and Nero wouldn't take it and kicked her. Well, she fell down some stairs, miscarried, and died. And then, of course, Nero was horrendously conscience-stricken at what he had done, if he had a conscience. But Tigellinus, again, arranged that a very pretty boy who looked like Poppaea would put a golden wig on, and Nero absolutely fell in love with him, her, and asked the doctors if they could possibly change him into a woman, and then married the boy. And the boy's name was Sporus. That's the sort of person Nero was at this point.
Now, you know, at this point, there are people who are... There are people who are saying, this is too strange to be true. People in the ancient world didn't behave themselves this way.
Oh, but they did.
But if you were an emperor, you could do as you please, couldn't you?
Well, yes. And you have to remember, too, we have a pagan society here. We have no strong ethical rules from a monotheistic God here. Only the Jews observe those and the Christians. The rest of Rome was terribly pagan. What amazes me, Todd, is that society didn't fall apart totally in the ancient world, because in the case of the Greeks and the Romans, look at the gods they had, the goddesses. They had Zeus, who chased everything in skirts, whether in Mount Olympus or down below or Hades, his brother Hades' area, and nobody was safe with Zeus around. And this is the god. This is the king of the gods. And a Greek man might be unfaithful to his wife. He couldn't compare with the conquests of Zeus. How come society didn't fall completely apart?
That's a very good question. What was Nero's reputation? He later assassinates his own mother. She's trying to kill him. He's trying to kill her. He finally succeeds.
Well, Nero by this time had lost so much in the fire of Rome later on that he now wants to recoup all his art treasures by raiding Greece. And so he now steals all their sculpture. When he was in Greece, he also competed in all their games. He made the Olympic Games and the Isthmian Games and so forth all gang up while he was there. And he won every race there was to win. Isn't that wonderful? He came back with 1,808 blue ribbons. And he was amazed at the impartiality of the justices. For example, at the judges, at Corinth, they had a 10-horse chariot race. And Nero just never had handled 10 horses, and he couldn't stand it, and finally fell out of the cab. The judges stopped the race, put Nero back in the cab, let him make up the laps, and even so, Nero could not hold out to the end, but the judges gave him the blue ribbon anyway. Such impartiality on the part of the justices.
Folks, it's easy to understand, given some of this context, how it could be that an emperor... He didn't necessarily have to be a bloodthirsty man, although Nero turned out to be one in the end. He didn't necessarily have to be a bloodthirsty man. Someone once said that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And in the person of Emperor Nero, we see that played out in spades. And we can understand why it is that he has very few qualms about persecuting the Christians all the way through the city of Rome simply because he's looking for a scapegoat for a fire that was merely a natural disaster. Our phone number is 1-800-730-2727. That's 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, Dr. Meyer, I want to hear about his attempted assassination on his own mother and then get us up, if you have other stories that fit well into this context, get us up to the time of the fire of Rome for a reprise of this persecution. And we can find out what exactly this persecution involved, not only its extent, but also the nature of the punishments that were meted out by the Romans against the Christians in this first of the persecutions. 1-800-730-2727. My guest is Dr. Paul Meyer, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He's authored numerous books, including this documentary novel that serves as the outline for our conversation, The Flames of Rome. We're talking about the events surrounding the first century Christian persecution in Rome. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
Folks, if you would like to purchase a cassette copy of this program for a contribution of $6.50, or if you want to receive Dr. Paul Meyer's book called The Flames of Rome for a total of $14, or if you'd like to order a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, it is free. Simply call our resource line at 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Dr. Meyer, in talking about these events that lead up to the first Christian persecution, I think a significant event is the interplay between the Roman Emperor Nero and his mother and her eventual death at his hands, or at least at his order. Tell us about their relationship and how she finally ends up assassinated by her own son.
It was a hopefully, I should say hopelessly dysfunctional family, to say the very least. Mama Agrippina was the wife of an emperor, Claudius. She was the sister of an emperor, Caligula. That was her full-blooded brother, so you can see the genes running in that family. And now she wanted to be the mother of an emperor as well. And she was all three. Very rare in Roman history. But she also, number four, wanted to be reigning co-empress. And the Romans had never had a woman in charge of the government. Now, that worked fine in Egypt. You have Hatshepsut, Cleopatra, Zenobia, Palmyra, and so forth. But it never happened in Roman history. And nevertheless, she wanted to make it happen. She insisted on equality with Nero. And Nero, at this point, is trying to resist his mother. And so she is threatening to put Britannicus on the throne instead. This is Claudius's son by a previous marriage.
A stepbrother to Nero.
A stepbrother to Nero, and that is why poor Britannicus was poisoned to death.
Did Nero poison him?
Nero poisoned him. Again, his mother didn't, but he did. But he was following Mama's recipe, shall we say. And then the climate got worse and worse between mother and son, and finally she was kicked out of the palace. And when she was away, Nero redid the ceiling of her bedroom so that concrete panels would fall out in the middle of the night when she came back and crush her to death. And when she came back, one of her ladies-in-waiting explained the alterations that had been made in the ceiling, and so she spent that night in the restroom. And then around 3 a.m., again, the ceiling fell in and crushed her bed beyond recognition. And she's ready to denounce Nero, but then he invites her down to the Bay of Naples, pleading with her for forgiveness, first of all, and a reconciliation banquet down in the Bay of Naples. And she goes down there, and Nero happily reinstates her as co-equal. He sends her home to her motel halfway across the bay in a collapsible cabin cruiser. According to his Tacitus's record, it had a trap door which would be opened and scuttle the ship in the middle of the bay. That way she would drown, the captain and crew would swim to shore, and tragedy, Mama would die. See, it had to be an accident. It looked rather tacky for a Roman emperor to murder his mother.
Now, he's already concerned about his reputation with the Roman Senate. He's concerned about his reputation with the people of the city of
Rome. And he wants to eliminate the problem of his mother, unfortunately.
Now, His attempt on her life fails. The collapsible boat.
It failed because, you will not believe this, they put the hinges in the wrong side. they had the trapdoor opening out instead of in. If they had it opening out, of course, the subsurface water pressure is going to keep it floating. It worked fine in dry dock. And by the way, that trapdoor was designed by the Admiral of the Roman Navy. So then they try to scuttle the ship by going to the starboard rail port side, until they were getting water over the rails. And Mama, at this point, it's around 1 a.m., dives off the ship because, surprise, Mama is a great swimmer. She is rescued by a flotilla of oyster fishermen. They bring her back to her motel, and then they bring Nero the good news that his mother has survived an accident at sea. At this point, Nero is fit to be tied. He sends his Marines at this point. They double time it around the bay. They smash down Nero's mother's bedroom door and clubbed her to death. This, by the way, Todd, very important for New Testament purposes, believe it or not. This is why Paul has to wait 2 years for his trial. You see, waiting 2 years for a trial, that's the American system of justice. It's not very Roman. Why does he wait 2 years for his trial? The tail end of the book of Acts, chapter 28. Because Nero was now so sensitive to public opinion that he had murdered his mother that he was afraid he would be stoned to death if he ever got to Rome. And for the next 18 months, he beats around southern Italy. He does not return to Rome. Paul's in Rome. Just about the same time, he can't see Nero until he gets back.
Now,
that's the reason for the 2 year wait.
That is very interesting. So it's not that the wheels of justice ground that slowly; it's that the judge
just
was afraid
there.
To come there.
Exactly.
All right. Let's take some phone calls. 1-800-730-2727. That's 1-800-730-2727. Rick in Bloomingdale, Illinois, listening on WYLL. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Hey, Rick, what's your question or comment?
What is the evidence that 11 of the 12 apostles were murdered by the Roman Empire?
Well, Rick, not just by the Roman Empire. We have Thomas, for example, going as far as India. Certainly the Romans didn't control that area. We have others going to other portions of the empire that was governed by Rome. John, the apostle, seems to be the only one who died a natural death. He became bishop of Ephesus, according to the early church historian Eusebius.
All right. So we do have all of these men. This is still in the context, even the later martyrdoms of the apostles, wherever we find them, it's still within the bounds of the Roman Empire?
Well, don't forget they controlled so much. They controlled everything from Spain in the west to Babylon in the east. And so most of these areas were controlled by Rome. That's right.
Okay. But only, as far as we know, only Paul and Peter ever make it to Rome and die in the environs of the city of Rome.
Eusebius again tells us very specifically that both did get to Rome and both were martyred, not at the same time, but nearly at the same time. Peter first had connection with the great fire of Rome and Paul subsequently.
The persecution that followed the Great Fire during Nero's reign of Christians, we talked before about how it came to be pinned on the Christians. How extensive was this persecution? You mentioned before a great multitude. Within the city of Rome, how many Christians were probably either arrested or lost their lives there?
All we have is the record in Tacitus, a pagan historian who was not interested in padding his figures on the Christians. He said, multitudo ingens in Latin, and by a comparative study elsewhere in Tacitus, that means a great multitude. High hundreds, thousands. I would guess 800 or 900, because this seems to be a very accurate tradition that comes along by the 400s AD.
Now, this is a sizable persecution regardless. I mean, 800, 900 Christians.
That's right.
Being put to death in retribution for the fire of Rome is a big number. But most Christians imagine hundreds of thousands of Christians being persecuted.
No, that's too many. And we also have to remember that the persecutions were not one long, horrible horror story that goes on for 2.5 centuries. No, it was an on-again, off-again, on-again, off-again situation. For example, under the Flavian emperors, Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian, there were no persecutions until the last years of Domitian's reign. Then, when the five good emperors come along, only the Christian superstars were martyred as kind of an example. Justin Martyr would be a case in point, or Polycarp, Bishop of Smyrna, people like that. But there was no wholesale executions, really, until the second century, the third century A.D., I should say, the 200s A.D.
During the Neronian persecution, how were the Christians persecuted? What punishments did the Romans inflict upon them?
Well, to quote Tacitus, he says, "And derision accompanied their ends. They were sewn inside of wild animal skins and made to fight with real animals. Or they were attacked by dogs. Or they were crucified or beheaded. And when daylight failed, they were impaled on posts, daubed with pitch, and set on fire."
Were these typical Roman punishments for people who ran afoul of the government?
Yes, they were typical, unfortunately, because there was a Roman bloodlust. That's not an attractive part of their character. Gladiatorial combat, of course, would be a case in point. Our bloody prize fights may come closer, our demolition derbies in terms of the various sports events that we have with stock cars and that kind of thing, where there's a lot of, you know, deaths involved, maybe something close. And I'm a little worried about American sports, you know, verging perhaps in some directions like that.
With only about 30 seconds to respond, can this be compared to what Christians go through in America today? What can 21st century Christians learn from knowing these events?
Well, certainly there's nothing paralleled in America to what's going on, but what the horrible fact is that there are persecutions of Christians taking place elsewhere in the world, even as we speak, and in numbers far greater than ever happened under Nero's persecution. And these people need our prayers. These people need our intervention with the government.
Dr. Paul Meyer, thank you very much. You've been an excellent guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He's author of numerous books, including this documentary novel titled The Flames of Rome. Folks, Christians have always been subject to on-again, off-again, sometimes more intense, sometimes less intense persecution. This is the lot that has been dealt us. We follow in the footsteps of our Savior, who went straight to the cross to give his life for us. This gives us hope in the midst of persecution, for Christ has risen from the dead, as will all those who have died in the faith, martyrs or not. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen to pastor and author Don Matzett on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.